You know, before this year, our state hadn't recorded a tornado during the month of February. Larry Mueller here. Today on the show, it's a weather update, and we'll start by talking about the tornadoes confirmed in southern Wisconsin with our half of the weather guys is here. The other half will be coming soon. Steve Ackerman with us, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin will be with us. He's finishing up his class, so he'll be with us along about noon. He's Professor and former Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back here talking about weather.
Talking weather. And by the way, I didn't give the number, but if you have a question, maybe about tornadoes, maybe about something else relating to climate and weather, I hope you'll call in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. So earlier this month, there were tornadoes confirmed in Dane, Rock, and Greene counties. And this was a very unusual event.
It's definitely unusual in the sense that it was also a very proud fact to be able to memorize that we never had a tornado in February in Wisconsin. Of course, the other part of that is January has only had three. So it's unusual, but now, you know, we have a tornado in every single month of the year. And these were pretty devastating. There was an F2 tornado, which was on the ground for over half an hour, 30 miles long, 500 yards wide, Ooh. Which just astounds me. You know, that's 5 football fields. I just can't imagine a thing that big.
I wouldn't have wanted to been in front of it.
No, right. Yeah, yeah.
We did. We had a lot of damage, but no deaths.
We had no deaths, right, that I'm aware of. Some houses were destroyed. Missing animals as well, so power lines down. I think I heard it was about $2.5 million worth of damages.
And, you know, the days leading up to the tornadoes, they were unseasonably warm. What were the specific conditions that led to it?
So typically when we have tornadoes like this, we have warm weather. I mean, that's why most of our tornadoes are in the season between May and August. And then when you have cold air come in over that, that makes the atmosphere really unstable. Because warm air is less dense than cold air. And so once you begin to lift that warm air near the ground, you can help generate these thunderstorms. And as long as you have upper-level support, so the right divergence up above in the upper troposphere, then you can get really severe weather. Thunderstorms develop, which we have had in February, just not severe thunderstorms.
Yeah. Chuck in Vernon County emailed, he'll be canoeing the Green River south of Moab, Utah, in Canyonlands National Park in mid-May for about 10 days, and he won't have access to technology. So he's wondering, what are some signs that might indicate incoming weather, particularly wind and precipitation?
Well, that's a really good question. What I would recommend is getting a weather radio so that if there is flooding going on, you know, heavy downpours in that river, you know, you could definitely get flooding in those rivers out in the west, particularly if there is canyons around. So I would get, emergency weather forecast, National Weather Service emergency weather radio, and that'll tell about severe.
You should be able to get that.
You should be able to get that, yeah.
And it would work.
It would work in those areas. It might, you know, if you're in a canyon, then it might be harder to get the signals. But the emergency broadcast system works across the U.S., so that's what I would listen for.
As you were talking, I was thinking about this last week when we interviewed the author of Gunflint Down, which was a derecho that hit July 4th of 1999 on 500,000 acres in the Gunflint on July 4th, all these people out in the woods.
Yeah.
And he wrote the book about what happened. And in that case, weather forecasting, that I think if that something like that were coming today,
we'd be much better than we were in the 1990s. Late 1990s, that's what it was, 1999?
1999, yeah.
I mean, back then, derechos were really being studied to try and understand what they were caused. These are also called straight line winds. They're just really strong winds, and there's a long line of them. And again, they often come out of thunderstorms as well.
Yeah, that one did. I think it took down 43 million trees.
43 million trees, Jace.
In the gunflint there, in the park.
Right. Wow.
So it was.
Was he in the park as well?
No, but he's been there many a time before and since, and so he interviewed many people who had been there during it. So it was a really fascinating. All those people, there were people who were injured, but not a single death. And when you look at the damage of a storm like that, I can see where Chuck in Vernon County might be.
Maybe he heard the
interview I did with the author of that book. Oh, my gosh. Rachel emailed, with an increase in tornado activity throughout the state, are there plans to expand and put in public tornado shelters? I have no idea about that.
I have no idea either. I mean, all the parks will have it. I'm sure there's a lot of, and we'll be seeing this as we approach more of our typical severe weather season, what to do when exposed or threatened by a severe weather. A lot of it is associated with, go to your basement. Mm-hmm. If you don't have your basement, go into a interior room like a bathroom, and if you really looks bad, get in the bathtub, and that'll also help protect.
Yeah, I was a news item came out today, how to protect your home. Things you can do to protect your home in case a tornado hits. Karen in Madison has a comment about a tornado warning. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I love your show, as you know. Maybe, but
thank you.
Back in 19, I think I was around 11 or 12, and that would be maybe 1965, 64, something like that. And it was January, and we were on our way to a gymnasium at a school function, and I heard tornado warning come over. Because I'm a disaster freak from birth. And so I said, I am not going anywhere, and refused to go. And she refused. She was pulling me out the door. There aren't tornadoes in Wisconsin in January. And now they're.
Yeah.
I just have a feeling that they're going to tell everyone in the country from now on, when there's severe weather, there's a chance an isolated tornado may come out.
Right.
Exactly. Well, January, and we've had three?
We've had three in January, so it is possible. I think it was six in December as well. So, yeah, when those sirens go off, there's a good reason to seek shelter, because that means it's that severe weather is in your... If you can hear the siren, then you're threatened by the weather.
Overall, we've had a kind of a weird winter. I mean, the temperature... I mean, do you have any comparisons of this year's temperatures and the amount of precipitation to previous years?
Most of southern Wisconsin is like 10 degrees above normal in terms of temperature. Madison area is really below in terms of precipitation. I think we've had less than 3 inches in snowfall, and typically we have 13 inches in February. I think Milwaukee has about average in terms of snowfall, and there's probably some influence from Lake Michigan there. But yeah, it's been a really weird weather. High temperatures being broken in Madison this last week. Our minimum temperatures for the day were typically above the normal highs for the area. I mean, that's just
amazing.
Just an odd year.
And just to go along with that, another report I got this morning was from the DNR, and There's a very high increased risk of fires, even in the northern part of the state where there's just not snow cover.
Yeah, we've been really, really dry as a state as a whole. I think only the southern western part has had close to normal. But yeah, real big fire dangers. Everything's dry, and we're going to have some wind move through the area on Tuesday and Wednesday. So
If you
burn your parts of your property in order to kind of support natural growth, be careful.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. It's a better advice.
Right now. And there's been wacky weather from other areas of the country.
Yeah, it's just been a really weird, weird year. And part of that is two things, I think. One is we still see, of course, the global warming trend that we've been experiencing now for decades. But also this is an El Nino year, and that usually means for the Wisconsin, upper Midwest, less snowfall and warmer type conditions. But it's been anomalous this year.
Well, we've got a number of emails rolling in, and I'm sure we'll be getting some questions as well. Steve Ackerman with us right now. I just looking through the glass, and I see John Martin has joined us and is waiting to come in as well. And he will be with us, too. And you can join in with your weather question or comment, or if you got an experience to share, we always love to hear those as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Steve Ackerman and joined by John Martin. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Getting a weather and climate update today on the show. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman with us, one of our guests for the rest of the show. He's the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and welcoming John Martin with us. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. It's nice to be here.
John's a professor and former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. So, weather and climate questions, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Dean, who's out west of Denver, Colorado, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hey, guys. Thanks for being out there. We enjoy listening to your show every month. Unfortunately, it's every month. Why isn't it twice a month, Larry?
You'll have to ask my executive producer, Jill Nadeau, about that. Oh, gosh.
Well, you know, and I have to keep notes in my mind for a whole month, one of which was a follow-up from Steve's comments last month about anemometers. And I was working with a research-grade sonic anemometer, uses 3 kilohertz sound waves to measure wind speed, and quite a remarkable invention, if you will. It has a resolution on the order of a millimeter per second.
Wow!
For wind
speed. That's unbelievable.
which translates to for those of non-metric folks to about 10 feet an hour.
Jeez, unbelievable.
So, that's amazing. Yeah. And that, you use that for research, or just you have that as your...
Yeah, I was working on surface layer meteorology. That's down near the Earth's surface. We're measuring carbon exchange using a technique called eddy covariance.
So,
there are a few firms out there making those, chief of which was in the U.S., outfit in Utah. But anyway, we used them quite, that was part of the regimen of measuring that exchange of carbon dioxide, for instance, between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. Anyway, last week, I think it was a sort of groundbreaking research that came out. I shouldn't say that, but anyway, it was more eye-opening, let's say that. On the shutdown of the Gulf Stream with the reduction of circulation and the overturning circulation in the Atlantic, which I guess is somewhat due to the meltwater coming off of Greenland. I was wondering if maybe you guys would fill in a little more of the details on what you think is the uncertainty of that prediction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dean, thanks for calling. John, go ahead.
Yeah, that is a troublesome prediction, Dean. I agree with you. My dad and I were talking about it the other day. In fact, he's concerned about it. There's a couple of high-profile factors that keep the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation going, and the Gulf Stream's part of that at the surface. And that is evaporation in the storm track in the northeast Atlantic, northwest Atlantic, south of the Labrador Sea in Greenland, and then cold air that physically cools the water, and both of those make it heavier, and it sinks at that location. And that sinking drives the whole circulation. So one of the things that's of concern is that if you start to flood the North Atlantic, the Northwest Atlantic, mouth of the Labrador Sea, with fresh meltwater, it changes the whole stability structure of the water column and prohibits the same intensity of subsidence of the sinking of the water. And that could be a big factor in shutting down the circulation. So to shade the discussion, I have a feeling that what's happened with these simulations is that the rapid cessation of that circulation is now one of the plausible solutions in these models. I wouldn't say that it's the most probable solution, and I think that that's probably where it lies. That it's not, if it happened tomorrow or next week or next year, a number of us would be surprised. Not everyone would be surprised. But I would say it's probably in the 5-10% probability event instead of, right in the heart of the most likely outcome for the next 10 or 15 years. That's my sense of it from a distance.
So what happens if, what's the worst case scenario on that?
Does this pick the Northern Europe? Is that where it really is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a suddenly, even Northern United States, Northeast United States, are suddenly thrust into a realm, a climate realm that's a lot colder than the one we have now. Because the Gulf Stream is pumping tropically warmed surface water and through a depth well poleward, and that water is an insurance policy against being at high latitude and being starved of photons and warming up in the winter. So we were just talking about it in class. People have palm trees on their little patios in front of houses in London. Now, there's no reason why that should be true latitude-wise, but it's because they're at the end of the Gulf Stream, and Northwest Europe has benefited from that for a long, long time, of course. If it suddenly shut down, things would be vastly different in a lot of heavily populated areas.
A lot colder.
A lot colder.
Lot longer.
A lot colder for a lot longer. So it's one of the wheels in the climate machine that is susceptible to change and maybe sudden change.
And would that then feed back in terms of sea ice conditions?
You'd think,
it's colder, so
yeah, you'd think it would.
Pretty quick.
Yeah, and then you put a little more ice at the mouth of the Labrador Sea. You can't have the evaporation. All sorts of things get out of whack. Yep.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, on that happy note, Dean, thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Jimmy in Valley Junction, we'll go to you next. Jimmy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I just had a question. It's supposed to be really warm for a few days and then drop like 35, 40 degrees to 25. I can't remember if it was Wednesday or Thursday.
Wednesday.
Normally, when you have such a temperature change, there's severe weather, and it doesn't appear that's the case this time. Do you know why it's not setting up for severe weather?
It's a good question, Jimmy. Part of the severe weather threat comes a little more in the warmer season, where you can still get a pretty decent, early in the warm season, you can get a pretty good drop in temperature, and you have to worry a little bit more about thunderstorms then. This air that's over us now is quite warm, but part of the reason it's warm is because it's been forced to subside in the lee of the Rocky Mountains, so it's moisture-starved. We don't really have a lot of water vapor in this air that's going to warm us up today and tomorrow. And so the consequence is when the cold front that's going to be fairly intense, the passage Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, is going to be really intense. There will be a 30-degree temperature drop in the high temperature from Tuesday to Wednesday, but it's not going to meet air that's got sufficient humidity to really play any nasty games with us, it doesn't look like. So that's part of it. And that's a function of being at the end of the winter as opposed to the middle of the spring, I think.
And then it warms up again.
And then it warms up. This is a very temporary cool down. Wednesday will be cold, and you'll be, you know, shedding your jacket Thursday afternoon because it'll be in the mid-40s and then 50 and 60 on Friday and Saturday. So, yeah.
There
amazing.
You go.
Roller coaster.
Jimmy, thank you for calling. Let's go to Carolyn in La Crosse next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I was just wondering what happened to those Canadian wildfires? How did they resolve any of that?
Yeah.
I've never heard.
That's a really good question. From last year, there was a lot of burning in the northwest and in the northwest and in the east.
In the east, too. Yeah.
Ontario. Yeah, all that smoke was coming over us.
I can tell you that this second winter in a row, the northeastern part of North America has been snow-starved. There has not been a lot of snow. And that was one of the factors that maybe led to the fires in Ontario. And I'd heard, and this is anecdotal only, so I can't tell you anything more than, and I don't even remember where I heard it, but a lot of this subterranean burning still at the root balls of trees. So some of those fires are not technically out yet. And so I don't know what that means for the coming fire season. As I said, that might be spectral evidence. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I've heard that. So,
but it is dry again.
Yeah, it's dry again. So. No snow. A lot less snow than normal up there. Yep.
And even here, because as Steve and I were talking earlier, the DNR just issued another fire warning.
Is that right?
For the state, the whole state. So, there's that problem. Carolyn, thank you. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ray in West Bend wonders, are there any insights on the clockwise spinning West Bend tornado of, he thinks, around 1980? Clockwise.
There's no preference, as it turns out, for clockwise or counterclockwise rotation of tornadoes. It really depends on the storm from which they're spawned. And so I shouldn't say there's no preference. Statistically, there is. Statistically, there is. But there's no dynamics that mandates that. I should have said it that way. Yeah.
So we do have
both
directions, counterclockwise and clockwise.
It's interesting. I wish I knew more details about the storm. But I think one thing that you can imagine is that the vorticity, the spin that comes from that manifests itself in tornadoes starts out as being oriented horizontally, not vertically. And so if there's a big updraft, you can split that horizontal vortex into two vertical vortices with opposite rotation. It's usually true that the one on the right, I think, which is going to turn counterclockwise, survives longer. But there must have been some circumstances that allowed the left one to survive in that case. And it may have left and right wrong.
Yeah.
Gene from La Crescent, Minnesota, had wondered about, this dry business, the large deficit of precipitation. Wondering what are the chances of overcoming that large deficit this spring and summer, and what is causing this drought?
Go ahead.
Two things came to my mind is, Jerry, we're in an El Nino year, and this usually means it's going to be drier in the upper Midwest. I think if you wanted to make it up, you don't want to make it up all at once. You would want to have just steady, gentle rain for multiple days to try and overcome the drought that we're in.
Anytime you're in the deficit, I couldn't agree more. It's the now the distribution that matters almost more than the amount.
Yeah,
if
right.
it's distributed incorrectly, it's worse
right,
than prolonging the drought almost. It's a very good question. I think that lack of snow on the ground is going to make it even worse.
Right. Yeah.
Because the ground will be dry. Now, on the other hand, maybe there's a benefit to that, that if you get a few exceptional rain events, the ground can absorb it better than it might otherwise, not having lost water over the wintertime. And so, you know, it's so many different factors that go into what the right answer is. But one of the right answers is it's got to start to precipitate. And it hasn't done that much in the last 8 or 9 months yet, that's for sure.
Back to the Canadian wildfires. Neil in Madison has some info on that. Let's go there. Neil, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, folks. My name's Neil. I live in Madison, and I have relatives in Canada. And actually, the information I got on the subterranean continuation of the wildfires came from the As It Happens radio show that I heard last Thursday on your radio station. And what they were saying is of the many hundreds of, actually many thousands of wildfires that happened last summer, some dozen of them are continuing underground because they're burning in an area that has fairly rich subterranean fire fuel. And the other thing that they has come out is they've found that some notable fraction of these fires were deliberately set. They've charged the Mounties have charged four people with arson in starting backcountry fires, and they suspect there's more of that going on. So anyway, just thought I'd feed that into the fire.
Thanks, Neil. Appreciating
that fuel.
Scott in Garden, Michigan, we'll go to you. Scott, hi.
Hi. Can you tell me the percent of El Nino years compared to the years with El Nino in the past?
Yeah, is there...
the ENSO oscillation is like, what is it, 2 to 7 years or something like that?
Right,
so I guess probably 30% of years are El Nino years historically, something on that order, but I don't really know. That's a good question. Yeah. But it's easy to look it up. The National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration has a page dedicated entirely to the El Nino Southern Oscillation, so you can find that information probably relatively easily. Although I bet you'd have to construct that particular piece of it.
I bet you would.
Just looking at the number of years and dividing by the total number of them, But I bet it's around 30-ish percent, my guess.
There you go, Scott. Thank you. Jolie in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jolie.
Hello. The question I want to ask is with the lack of snow that Wisconsin is having, and how is that going to affect the lakes in northern Wisconsin and the Mississippi River?
That's a really good question. I was actually looking at that, although I didn't look at the level of the Mississippi River. The Madison area lakes are all at their current wintertime minimum, and I think they're trying to maintain that. Michigan, to my surprise, is just about its normal level, Lake Michigan.
I thought that
would be below. And I didn't find the data on what the status was for Lake Superior. But I would have thought that both of those, due to the lack of winter ice coverage, would have evaporated and been lower than normal.
So maybe the extra ingredient is there has to be a parade of storms that bring the winds up over the lakes. And we haven't really
had that.
You know, so there's less evaporation then. But I didn't know it was so sensitive to the wind speed over the integration of 90 days in the winter. Maybe it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
It would have an effect on the amount of lake weeds and algae. If you've got snow cover, if you don't have snow cover, there's sunlight getting through the ice and keeping those plants alive.
Hey, yikes. That makes it worse then.
That'll actually make it worse.
I was just thinking of the Madison lakes now.
No kidding. Oh, my God.
We had a listener call us, couldn't stay with us. There's a movie called Kiss the Ground. It's about how we do agriculture and how it dries the soil. We don't use cover crops a lot. There was an image from a NASA satellite about the hot air circulating the globe. They called it a red zone, and hot air that rises into the atmosphere while farmers are harvesting. She wondered if that was accurate, and I don't know that we have that information offhand, but Steve?
Yeah, I'd want to see what the map looks like to get it, but if we generally have dry conditions and no clouds, then this NASA satellites are going to be able to see down to the ground and do accurate measurements of the surface temperature, and that might lead to low-level temperatures above normal in the atmosphere because the ground is so warm. I mean, once the ground gets wet or you have snow cover on there, that solar energy isn't going to heat the ground.
Yeah. And at harvest time, once you take the, you know, the stalks down of cornfields, for instance, it is going to be, if the next day is sunny, it's going to be warmer over your field because you got brown dirt exposed that you didn't have exposed for months. Yeah. So I think the choice of, quote, hot air is intentionally provocative. However, I think it might mean elevated temperatures on the next day or something. But, you know, the atmosphere can absorb that. That happens quite naturally.
That's true. That red area is probably departure from normal.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Denise in Blanchardville, your turn. Hi, Denise.
It's Dennis.
Dennis.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question. I guess, can you... be, I guess, completely honest in saying that the jets in the jet stream, the sheer quantity of them, is not affecting our weather, especially our distribution of rainfall? I mean, because after all, those jets moving through the jet stream are molecularly changing, you know, that pattern up there. So, I mean, can you honestly say that the jets... And they project that there's anywhere from 60 to 65,000 jets on a daily basis flying in the jet stream. I don't know if that's accurate, but I mean, I don't see how that cannot be influencing our weather, especially our distribution of, because I've been an amateur astronomer for 67 years. And what I notice, and that is I can tell the corridor between Minneapolis and Chicago, that corridor, the sky, as I look through it with pretty large telescopes, I can actually tell the difference in that in the early part of the evening and actually throughout the night, as opposed to areas that's not where that corridor is constantly being bombarded with jets going through. And that's the reason why I say that. To me, it just seems like a no-brainer. That's having a
is working.
Influence.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well.
I mean, one of the things, particularly for astronomers, with the when the jets are up there, if the conditions are right in terms of the vapor structure in the atmosphere, they can generate contrails, and they can spread out and get a thin cirrus all across a region. But it's not. They're not going to be. I can confidently say they're not going to change the jet stream.
Yeah.
It's just too much mass.
It's a problem of proportion, as Steve's pointing out. It's definitely true. There's no doubt that locally at a moment there's some impact, but systematically there's no impact because the mass of the atmosphere and the way it's distributed by solar radiation and everything is overwhelms these perturbations, which doesn't argue for making more of them, certainly, but it does not have any systematic impact.
Yeah, it's like having a football team out on a team. You know, you can have a lot of them running really, really fast, but if the day is windy, they're not going to influence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They won't change the wind structure in the stadium. Yeah, that's right.
So it's good, the proportion.
That's an excellent description.
Dennis, thanks for calling. John in Onalaska, have you got a quick question?
Yeah, I've been worrying about the India. You know, India has a period where it gets very, very hot. And then, of course, the rains come and cool things off. But those rains are very important for all of Southeast Asia. And I've heard that might change. What do you know about that?
I don't know about forecasts for the global monsoon to be substantially impacted or in what way. I wouldn't say that I would never say that no one's made those predictions and followed the reasoning all the way to the end. I just am not aware of it. I know there are stops and starts to the Indian monsoon. Some years it's very beneficial. Some years it's not. It doesn't come on till late, and it doesn't really deliver the rain that the country and the region expects. But that's been true for hundreds of years. I don't know if it's become exacerbated in the modern era. I don't know that.
Matt in Appleton wonders, will 2024 be seen as the beginning of the end of winter in Wisconsin?
No.
I don't know.
At least I speak hopefully.
Yeah, me too. Mine's entirely ambition. I don't want this to be a winterless place. On the other hand, property values will go up. I mean, really, this might be a climate oasis the way things seem to be going. You know.
On that happy note, we will conclude today. Thank you so much, John and Steve, for being with us. Always a pleasure. And we'll see you the last Monday of the coming month. Steve Ackerman is one of our guests today, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, our guests. Tomorrow it's a pet care day, so we'll look at puppies and getting a puppy and covering everything connected with it. That's tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.